All right. Welcome to the N1C Fireside Chat Podcast. Today we have Logan Newton from SickKids here to kind of lead us through some discussions and a great panel. So let's just go around first and do some introductions. I am Steph Leonard. I'm the project manager for the N1 Collaborative. And Logan, you want to start and kick us off?
Yeah, I'm Logan Newton. I'm a first-year Master's of Science student in the Molecular Genetics program at the University of Toronto. I'm a member of Dr. Gregory Costain's lab, who's a physician scientist at SickKids, specializing in the diagnosis of rare genetic conditions in children.
And I'm Annemieke Aartsma-Rus. I work at the Leiden University Medical Center, and I've been working on developing exon-skipping treatment mainly for Duchenne muscular dystrophy, but I'm now also branching out to the rare brain diseases as well.
Hi, I'm Annie Laufer. I'm a postdoctoral researcher working with Annemieke in Leiden in the Netherlands, and I'm responsible for selecting and identifying variants and candidates for individualized RNA therapies.
And I'm Willeke van Rommel. I'm a professor at the Leiden University Medical Center working with Annemieke and Marleen. My expertise is in hereditary brain disorders and have been developing RNA targeting therapies and also now applying this knowledge to NF1 treatments.
Hi, I'm Lynn Bush. I'm at Boston Children's Hospital. I'm faculty and Harvard Medical School. I'm a developmental scientist and a bioethicist and a member of the Center for Bioethics at Harvard Medical.
Thank you guys all for being here for today. Logan, I'm going to turn it over to you and you can start the discussion.
Great, thank you. So I want to start off by saying that I joined this field of research just 6 months ago. So I'm very grateful to have this opportunity to discuss my thesis project with leading minds in the field such as yourselves. So just start off by saying thank you for speaking with me. And I'll start talking about our lab. So our lab works out of the SickKids Research Institute, and it is very much part of the hospital's precision child health movement. And a major focus of our work is on diagnosing faster, treating smarter, and predicting better so that we can effectively and efficiently address the unique needs of every child. But my project is more so focused on the treat smarter branch of that trinity. And its ultimate goal is to streamline and advance the development of new precision therapies and bring these next generation therapies into fruition. But before I delve into the specifics of my project, I want to start off by painting a bit of a bigger picture about what rare diseases are in general and what the significance of this project is. So a rare disease is a condition which affects less than 1 in 2,000 individuals. And depending on your location, that figure might change a bit. So that's the Canadian figure that I'm giving. But in the States, you'd be more likely to hear something like a rare disease being one that fewer than 200,000 people live with. Something that I think is that the title of rare disease is actually a bit of a misnomer. While each condition is individually rare, rare diseases altogether are relatively common. And with an estimated 475 million people affected by a rare disease worldwide, this type of patient is actually not rare at all. And of the more than 7,000 described rare diseases, 80% are genetic and etiology and 70% exclusively pediatric in onset. In Canada alone, the number that you'll hear is around 500,000 children being affected by a rare genetic disease. And this significantly contributes to our pediatric morbidity and mortality. It's even more important to note that therapeutic options remain few and far between for this population, with less than 5% currently having effective treatments. And with that being said, I can now focus on what my thesis project actually is. So just big bold letters is pretty much precision medicine and tailoring our treatments to the characteristics of a singular patient. So in theory, a rare genetic disease patient is an ideal candidate for precision medicine because the underlying cause of a rare genetic disease is often revealed in conjunction to diagnosis itself. And a major focus of SickKids precision medicine research is on antisense oligonucleotides, or ASOs. And I'll just briefly talk about what these are. They're short synthetic single-stranded DNA sequences, which bind to complementary regions of mRNA via Watson-Crick base pairing to modulate splicing or induce degradation. So an ASO that's capable of mediating an event referred to as exon skipping is specifically what my project is focusing on. So what that is an ASO that can bind to exonic splicing enhancers or splice sites, can pretty much hide an exon from splicing machinery and result in its exclusion from the mature transcript. So if an exon containing a pathogenic loss of function variant is hidden from splicing machinery and removed via an ASO, it's possible that we can obtain a truncated but still partially functional protein product, and that this could ameliorate for the loss of function and relieve some of the disease phenotype. And this approach has yielded promising results to date. I think there are currently 5 FDA-approved ASOs, with 4 of those intended to treat the same condition, Duchenne muscular dystrophy. So the landscape of ASOs and treatable variants remains largely uncharted. And what my project aims to do is obtain a comprehensive understanding of which exons and human disease genes are skippable by ASOs. So to do this, I'm using consensus guidelines that were developed by the N1C in partnership with our team at SickKids. And to facilitate this, I'm using a high throughput workflow, which extracts and reformats data from various sources to provide exon-specific information that is pertinent to our assessment guidelines. And the genes that I'm using in this analysis are referred to as the Mendelian, which is approximately 5,000 protein coding genes that are known to be associated with monogenic diseases and Mendelian inheritance. So that's where I'm at right now. And what I just described is the first aim of my project. I have 3 aims total, and I can introduce those other 2 later in the talk, but just so I don't drone on for too long at the start, maybe I can open up the floors to others.
And maybe I can ask the first question to you, because so the focus is primarily on diseases where there is a mutation within an exon, where you think if I use an ASO to skip that exon, I will bypass the mutation. And well, the goal is then to have a partially functional protein, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. A partially functional protein.
Yeah. So we're not talking about cryptic splicing and thing and the Tango approach, just like skipping an exon to bypass a mutation and allow a partially functional protein.
At this point in the project, just exon skip.
Yeah, clear.
So can I ask how you determine functionality of your novel? Because you skip an exon, so you get a truncated protein. So do you have an in silico way of actually ensuring that your protein is still functional or partially functional? Or how do you determine which function is located in which part of the transcript?
So we don't have any in silico tools right now at the moment. The point of this project is like a very preliminary step to guide which exons can then be validated functionally. So it provides a list of exons that we think are probably or possibly skippable. And the next step would be functional evidence using a cell line or a patient-derived cell line. So it's just to guide and sort of streamline that initial assessment and make it to expedite or make faster the process of just determining which exons are like should be examined functionally for skipping.
And but
sorry, go ahead.
The approach you're currently taking, I see, is more like agnostic. So you do not look into the disease and the gene and the phenotype, because right now, as you said, there are, of course, a few FDA-approved exon-skipping drugs for Duchenne. But I think Annemieke will agree with me that the current efficacy of these drugs is limited because the delivery to the muscle is a problem. And at the moment, many of the strategies are focusing on local delivery to the neural system. So what is your approach?
Sorry, my approach to... Could you repeat?
Yeah. Are you looking specifically into diseases that you know might be treatable, or are you really at the moment looking at any kind of gene and any kind of exon, not taking into account if that would be something that you could deliver a drug to?
Right. So right now, what we've done is we've looked at any disease gene, which is around 5,000 genes. But from this list of genes, we're going to create a set that we consider more targetable depending on like affected tissue like liver or retina, or if it can be administered to the CNS, considering things like disease progression and age of onset would be what we would use as criteria to create a smaller gene list from which we would actually want to then move on to that next step, which was mentioned earlier about function, more so manually validating and moving past that high throughput process and more so into the one person sitting there looking at each exon and maybe getting a cell line and validating functionally. So we are looking at creating a smaller gene list from our larger gene list that we think would be the diseases and the phenotypes would be more targetable using ASOs.
And I think, so to come back to what Marlene was saying, so I think, but there's two different ways you can look at it. You can say, well, we know where we can deliver. We can deliver for now. We know brain and eye and liver. We can deliver with high efficiency. There are 4 approved ASOs for Duchenne, but that doesn't mean that delivery to skeletal muscle is solved, because as you probably know, these approvals were on very low levels of protein restoration and functional effects have not yet been shown. So I think the advantage of focusing first on the transcripts and then narrowing it down to which tissues can we reach, the advantage of that is that what we of course hope is that in the future there will be more tissues that we can reach. And people are working on that. Well, if you start with which tissues can we reach now, then you would have to do an extra step if we can at some point hopefully also deliver to muscle. So I think this approach is good, but I also definitely agree with Marlene that you have to narrow it down to what is currently feasible delivery-wise. And I think we agree on the tissues that we can currently sufficiently reach.
Something else I'm wondering about, you just said you really take all these about 5,000 genes from the mendelium, but you also talk about loss of function variants. So not all of these genes have diseases that are associated with loss of function variants. Some of them are only associated, for example, with gain of function variants. Are you taking these type of pattern mechanisms also into account?
We are taking these types of pattern mechanisms into account. So at this point, we're mostly considering autosomal recessive loss of function variants is being targetable with our ASOs, but we are still assessing the mendelium as a whole, just in, as with what was being said earlier by Enamike, for like future purposes. I think you can target gain of function mutations with an ASO, but it would require different guidelines and different considerations to be taken, which are not part of what we are doing in this project.
Maybe that's a nice addition for the people who are considering skipping an exon for gain of function variants. It's mainly to do with efficiency. So if you have a loss of function and you restore 10% of protein, that likely will have a therapeutic effect. However, if you have a toxic gain of function and you have 10% efficiency, you go down from 100% to 90%. And most likely that is not going to do much in terms of efficiency. So I think that's probably a good consideration as a side note.
Logan, at the beginning, you also talked about the consensus guidelines that we developed with the N-of-1 collaborative and also, of course, in collaboration with SickKids. And I'm biased a little bit because I was involved in it. But maybe for the audience, you might want to elaborate a little bit on what are criteria we are looking for in exons that we can skip. And how are you approaching this? Like, what are you excluding? What are you including? What are the things you're looking for?
Sure, yeah. So the assessment guidelines developed by the N1C and SickKids are what I'm using for this project. We're taking a very conservative, high-throughput approach to it. So initially, exons are excluded or included based on their position and frame. And this is hard exclusion criteria. So an exon that is the first or last coding exon is excluded from skipping. An exon that is out of frame is also excluded from skipping, because skipping an out of frame exon would abolish the open reading frame and result in non-functional gene product. If skipping an exon were to result in the formation of a stop codon by joining together its preceding and the exon that comes after it, that exon would also be excluded from skipping. So an exon that would move past exon position and frame assessment would be one that is not first to last coding, one that is in frame, and one that doesn't result in the formation of a stop codon. And majority of the exons that were excluded in our analysis were excluded at this step. And then we moved on to the role of functional domains and also the role of exon size. So with this criteria here was where we added a, or where was where there was a sort of middle ground classification of possibly skippable. So stuff that exons that code for important functional domains or code for the a known mutational hotspot are not immediately excluded because we would need functional evidence to sort of validate what that domain is doing. If the exon codes for the only functional domain in the protein, it's more likely that it's excluded. But then again, all of the functional domain assessments still need functional validation. And then for exon size, if the exon coded for greater than 10% of the protein coding transcript, it was less likely to be skippable and then moved into our possibly group. So that's where we got three groups of exons from this, from these guidelines. We had our hard exclusion group, which was the majority of exons. Then we had our possiblys, and then we had our probablys, which made it past the exon frame and size. So our exon frame and position had no functional domains and coded for less than 10% of the transcript.
Right. Thank you. And you're talking about the past, so I assume you have done some of this work already?
This is done. Yeah.
Yeah.
We've assessed the 5,000 genes approximately and around 70,000 exons, and they've been put into three-ish groups. Sometimes we combine the excluded with the possiblys and just have two hard excluded included groups. But yeah, that step is done.
Right. And so where are you at right now? And is there anything that you kind of need maybe input for or something we can help with?
Yeah, well, something that I wanted to ask about was what was mentioned earlier. I wanted to gain some insight on how your groups prioritize or triage diseases for ASOs, like other factors that I should consider besides target tissue and age of onset and progression in making a smaller gene list that I should assess manually. Because I think that's mostly my next step.
I can start and start and then Willeke and Marleen can add. So I think triaging, so what we have come to realize is that assessing whether someone, because it's you're now focusing on the exon and you're focusing on specific diseases, but of course there's also a patient behind this. And we've come to realize that whether someone is eligible really depends on three different things. So step one, is the mutation eligible? And then, well, you look, as you explained, is the exon, in this case, is the exon in frame? If we skip it, how likely is it that the protein will be functional? But of course, it's also the disease. So if it's a disease where everything goes wrong in utero, we're only going to give the ASOs postnatally. So if everything goes wrong, if there's embryonic malformations of the brain, we won't be able to undo that. If someone is born blind, we won't be able to undo that. So it's also the disease. So when does it go wrong? And if it's a progressive disease, then of course, treating someone, you expect an impact because you hope to slow down the progression. But if all the harm is done before birth, probably not. Or if someone has progressed so far, then probably not. So you see the disease, but you already also see the link to the patient, because even if the disease is very eligible, if the patient is too far advanced, then the patient might not, well, you might not expect benefit. And if you do intrathecal injection, that in itself is a burden. And if then you expect only very little benefit, maybe that just doesn't outweigh the burden of the treatment. So it really, it's not just the, is this exon eligible? But I think for you, because you won't have all the specific patient data, also the disease. So when does the pathology start? Is there a progressive component? Do I still expect benefits? I think that is probably the most important thing. And let's see whether Marleen and Willeke have something to add.
No, I can see Lynn has got something to say first, and then we all also have some additions.
I was just going to add to that, to build on what Anamiki said, which I think is so important, is looking at the proportionality. So there are so many factors in considering, even if a family would want to do something, because there's desperation, there's no other treatments and such, always weighing in the factors of there's great uncertainty no matter what we're doing, and there's always risk. But where do you think the dial can really, in your assessing, before you even speak with the patient, is where you think it can help the most, and with any given patient population, as we all sit on the patient identification committee, is really thinking for any given patient, as well as for advocacy groups, of really being clear and communicating where you see any potential help and where there may be that tension, and then weighing how early and what's both too late or what may even be too early to assess. But if you know that there's treatment that may, a potential investigational treatment that may help early on, knowing it's going to take a while for some cases, as we've seen with AT and some other cases in the ULAB and elsewhere and in Germany, of really assessing how patient can both the family be in enduring with some of the treatments, some of the intrathecals, and how long it will take where you can even make an assess whether there's a potential benefit. So that gets weighed in as well.
Would actually recommend taking a step back. So I fully agree with everything that was said. It's already going very much towards the patients, but I understand you now have a data set and you want to start prioritizing and looking, can you narrow down your targets? So one thing I would recommend to do is you now have these exons that fulfill those criteria. Check if those exons are even expressed in transcripts that are expressed in the gene, in the tissue of interest. Like, is this exon even expressed in the brain? Are these actually valid transcripts? And if you were to skip, how much of the protein can you rescue? If that transcript is only expressed at 5% in your target tissue, the effects you're going to have with an azo that probably will only skip 20%, so it's like 20% of 5%, is getting very, very low. But if it's a highly relevant transcript that is expressed at 80% of the levels, then you might have some more benefit. So I think if go one step back and first start, what are the transcript levels of this exon? Like, in which transcript is it expressed? What are these expression levels? Is it in the target tissue that we want? And is there even the potential to rescue something? And then the next thing I would look into, if you then have genes, check if they also have expression in tissues that you can easily obtain. That could be fibroblasts, that could be any type of blood cells, that could be an iPSC line, it could be something you can differentiate, but something that might be easily obtainable. And then the other thing, are these genes where you can have easy readouts? You don't want to go too complex, but if it's an easy bioenzymatic assay, biochemistry that you have, and you can do, and sometimes you can even combine different genes because they're involved in the same pathway. So this way you can start narrowing down and prioritizing the genes and exons of interest.
Yeah, and I think you need to have some sort of disease mechanism already, because that will also determine your assays. And for instance, if there is iron accumulation in the brain, but there is no way you can link your gene to actually causing iron accumulation, how are you going to measure efficacy, or how do you know that this is important? So I think all of these things, if there's nothing known about this gene and nothing known about the function, then it'll get really difficult really quickly.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. In addressing what you had mentioned a bit, Marlene, what we had looked at quickly a little bit ago was whether or not the genes that made it past our assessment and in our probably or included group, whether or not they had a TPM above 10 in tissues that we think we can target. And I can put some numbers on that. Around half the genes in our included list had a TPM above 10 in retina, around 20% in liver, and 30% in the brain. So those were just something that we did early on and just checked. So those are the numbers we have on the greater than 10 TPM. I don't know, we assigned that kind of arbitrarily to check if it had a moderate to high expression. So I'm not sure.
Maybe we should quickly say that TDM stands for transcripts per million, and this is an expression level measurement. But the thing is, did you look for the gene or for the specific transcript with that exon?
The gene.
Yes. So you might really want to start looking for the specific transcripts, right? There's data sets out there where you can really check if those transcripts that have that exon are expressed at certain levels, right? The gene itself does normally not help you if that exon is maybe not in one of the main transcripts. So that's something you you want to look into. And then the other thing, and I think you might have that taken that into account, but something we should discuss as well. Have you seen maybe that this is already skipped in healthy individuals? Do you know of any data sets where you can show, hey, we have maybe patients with another disorder that's not connected to this disease with this gene, where there's a deletion of this exon that could give you a hint or an idea that this might be an exon that can be, well, lost not, but maybe skipped without doing too much harm?
Like checking the literature to see if the exon has been skipped already?
Yeah, or on in publication databases and general population databases to see if there's anything known that there might be a deletion, not only of this exon, but of multiple exons. Sometimes we see that in some cases, and that this individual is not affected by this disorder. Of course, that will then give you more evidence that this might be a skippable exon. Yeah. And did you also look into conservation scores of these exons?
We have the conservation scores. We haven't looked into them yet, but we do have them as part of our high throughput analysis. So they are in there, but it's something that we haven't started to analyze yet.
Yeah.
And looking to see if there's evidence of skipping the exon in literature is something we also plan on doing with our more curated and smaller list.
And something to add there is that, of course, so seeing if the exon is skipped and whether that's tolerated, that's one thing. But if you see that a patient with the deletion of that exon has the same pathology as someone with a nonsense mutation, for instance, that will also tell you like, okay, we cannot skip that exon. And of course, that's not really data you want to hear, but I mean, knowing it will help you to develop something that might not be useful. And then maybe a question for you, because one of the mutation types that we often get from people when they email, can you do exon skipping for this disease or that disease, are missense mutation. So how do you look at missense mutations? And then you can also share how we look at them, but they're challenging and tricky, we think.
So in addressing that first part about whether, like if a deletion of that exon contributes to pathology, we excluded exons that contain in-frame indels. So any exon that's in our included group contains no in-frame indels in ClinBar. So that was taken into consideration. With regards to missense variants, the problem with missense variants is that a missense variant in that exon that contributes to pathogenicity suggests that that exon already plays some sort of functional role, and that changing the one amino acid residue that results in a different impacts function likely suggests that skipping that exon itself would also impact the function of the protein. So missense variants are harder to assess than nonsense variants. And what we've started looking at with our data set is the proportion of missense to nonsense variants in our included exons. And what we've seen is that for our included group, the number of SNVs that exist in ClinBar, right. So in our included group, around 51% of the SNVs are nonsense. So, and in our excluded group, 45% are nonsense. So our included group has more nonsense mutations than our excluded group. And that was something that we were hoping to see, was that most of the SNVs in ClinBars are ClinBar are nonsense SNVs, because we believe that those are more targetable by ASOs, because it suggests that those exons play less of an, or that those mutations don't hint towards it being a functional exon with a functional role.
Yeah, well, we actually look at it exactly the same way, like almost verbatim. Like if just changing one amino acid is that causes a problem, then this is probably a domain that this protein cannot do without. So yeah, so we're in agreement there.
I think another question I have, how did you deal with these exons having canonical splice site variants in databases? How did you take that into account? Did you exclude them? Did you look into them closer? Because I think that's a discussion that's ongoing a lot. If there's a canonical splice site variant, does it mean that does this variant cause exon skipping, or does it maybe cause a different splicing defects? How did you look at them?
Canonical spliceosome variants are not included in our high throughput analysis, so it hasn't really been taken in consideration. That would be something we would look at, again, more manually on a smaller scale. So I can't comment on canonical spliceosome variants or intronic variants because we have not taken those into consideration.
Yeah, I have to rephrase my question. I think I wasn't clear. I'm sorry. I'm talking more about if you now have an exon that you think might be skippable and there are known canonical splice site variants on this exon, how would you deal with that? How do you take that into account?
We would have to see if the canonical splice site variant results in skipping of that exon and if that drives pathogenicity. We would have to check functionally and look in the literature to see if that's a mechanism of pathogenicity. And if it is, then we would exclude that exon.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
Yeah. Because, of course, you expect that if the canonical splice site is mutated, you expect that the exon will be deleted on RNA level. But there's no guarantee. And I think that's a good thing to check.
So at this moment in the project, we have a list of exons that we've identified as probably skippable. And I also refer to that as the included group. And these exons are spanning about 2,000 genes. And something we're trying to see is if genetic variants in these genes contribute to phenotypes and symptoms targeted by ASO. So again, touching on what we were talking about with triaging and prioritizing disease genes and phenotypes. So what we're trying to do is pull gene to phenotype relationships from databases like the Human Phenotype Ontology. But to do so, we're trying to first pick appropriate HPO terms to look for gene to phenotype relationships. And I was hoping we could discuss which HPO terms or phenotype terms you would think would be best to look for and why. So something that we've looked at so far, like which genes are related to stuff like retinal degeneration, progressive night blindness, stuff like ataxia. But there are things that we are having some debate about do we include something like intellectual disability? Like, is that something we target with an ASO or can we measure it with an ASO? So what phenotypes or HPO terms would you most likely want to see the genes associated with or not associated with?
So I do a less systematic approach, I have to say, but it has been working, I hope, a little bit for me. So I go into OMIM and gene review. So I don't go into the HPO terms, actually. And I open case reports with sometimes more systematic case reports. And then I literally just type in something like progressive or non-progressive. I look into something that's called a decline or regression. So I look for something that gives me an idea if there is a progression of symptoms, but often it's not called progression. It could be cognitive decline or developmental regression, which shows a progressive phenotype, but is not that. So you need to find some of these little terms that give you an indication of, is there a development going on? And development, by that I mean, is something going worsening over time? Because if you have a disease that's at a plateau and doesn't improve or progress or anything, it will be very hard for you to measure something. So I'm looking for, let's say, a dynamic in the phenotype.
Right. Thank you. Okay. And another thing that has been a bit of a problem in this approach is HPO has a lot of nested terms. There'll be like an overarching term like global developmental delay, and then a lot of nested terms like mild, moderate, severe. Would you, if I were to continue in this sort of approach, would you combine those phenotypes into one and just take it as an overarching global developmental delay and add up all the genes and the proportion of genes? Or should it be like, how do you prioritize which phenotype would be more important? Is it just the more severe phenotype?
I think at this, yes, difficult, because at this moment we say we're of course focusing on severely debilitating disorders. So I think I would start with those, the ones that are most severe and that will benefit most from a treatment. But we don't know what's going to lie ahead in the future. And I mean, you're now making this database or this data set for us to profit from a long time. That's how I understand it. So I think you have to take multiple levels into account. So what we did, and I'm happy to also offline discuss this with you a bit more, we started ranking the disorders. So the most severe to the more milder ones, and then started looking firstly in the more severe cases, and then we kind of going backwards into the more milder phenotypes. But that might be an approach that that you might be benefiting from as well, to start with the severe cases, but don't forget the others that in the next few years we might also be able to target.
Yeah, so maybe to elaborate a little bit more about that, because at this point, there's only very few cases where N of 1 ASOs have been tried. So we are still in the data gathering, and there's a lot of, like, the risk, maybe not that much, but especially the uncertainty, there's a lot that we don't know. So the acceptance of uncertainty and the acceptance of the unknown, which also includes risks, is higher for progressive diseases than for, say, less progressive diseases. So that's probably why at first the focus will be on these fast progressive diseases, where there's just more acceptance and tolerance for risk and uncertainty. But obviously, the more we know, and the more we know, like, this actually will work, the more also the slower progressive diseases will become potential targets. And again, that's the same thing that we had the discussion with, the which tissue do you focus on. It's better to build this system now in such a way that we also can use it in the future where things are changed, than that you now build it very narrowly so that we can use it now, but then when things change, you have to rebuild it. So I think the approach that you do, where you already look forward to a future where hopefully this is more widely applicable, I think that is the best way. But having a prioritization tool would be good.
And also maybe for validation purposes, I'm always surprised if I look in the literature that people have actually done already exon skipping on a certain transcript for a certain gene. So maybe you can also do sort of a text-based search of the PubMed abstracts or something and see if you can find something that a group has already tried skipping a particular exon that occurs in your database or from your search.
Okay, thank you so much. And another thing I'm trying to do with this data is maximize what we can take away from it. So we've been looking a lot at the exons we've identified as included, and just put some numbers on it. This probably or possibly skippable group spans nearly 80% of the genes in our analysis. What that leaves us with is 20% of the genes in the Mendelium contain no skippable exons. And some of those might just be genes that just are only one or two exons in length that would just be immediately excluded. But I was wondering if anyone here thinks there would be any value in looking at this gene list, genes that contain no skippable exons, and if there should be a search for certain patterns among those genes that some sort of conclusion could be drawn from.
That sounds very interesting. But I would also really, you know, look at already known skippable exons and see if they come up in your top hits, because that would be already be kind of a validation. I mean, there are enough studies done on splice modulating with ASO, so yeah, you can make a list and see if they actually occur high in your list. But there are also exons that we cannot skip, yeah? And it doesn't matter how hard we try, so we never published this, but it would be nice to know if there are, exons that are not, genes that don't have any skippable exons.
Thank you guys so much. I think we're just about at time. So I want to thank Logan for coming on and presenting your work, and then also Anamika, Marlene, Willeka, and Lynn, for being such a great panelist here. And we hope that you guys have enjoyed this podcast and have learned. If you have any additional questions, comments, or other ideas or topics for podcasts, please feel free to reach out to the N01 Collaborative, and we will talk to you guys all later.